Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My guest today lives in the suburbs of Viola, a small town between Mount Lassen Volcanic Park at Shingletown. Shelley Renee Joy moved up to Shingletown from San Francisco 7 years ago after completing coursework for a PhD. She wanted to live in a quiet, natural setting to write her dissertation, which she completed in 2016. She had attended Rice University on a physics scholarship and graduated with a degree in electrical engineering, then worked on interspecies communication and pursued contemplative practice with a well-known Buddhist meditation master. Shelley Joy, among the 7 books that Shelley Joy has published, is a 2017 book, Tuning the Mind, Geometries of Consciousness. And now she has a new book, Developing Supersensible Perception. Shelley Joy, welcome.
I'm glad to be here.
Now, I mentioned that you are from Viola, and it's such a small town, I'll bet most people have never even heard of it.
Even people who live in the big city of Shingletown, which has, I think, about 1,000 people, that's about 10 miles away. And Viola has a population of 99, and we live in the suburbs right near the entrance to Mount Lassen Volcanic Park.
That's a pretty high altitude.
It's about 5,000 feet. Yeah, the air is really nice and the stars at night. And we have a well, but it actually went dry during the drought a few years ago. So we learned what it's like to haul water up the mountain to live a little bit pioneering, I guess.
Well, it must have been such, I would even call it perhaps culture shock, to move from San Francisco to this tiny little town in the mountains.
It was. There were things we didn't have any idea that we'd encounter, little problems, you know, but we quickly adapted, and it's so quiet. It's great for walking and meditating and just a lot of wildlife, too.
Now, speaking of meditating, back when you were growing up, that was not something people did.
No, not at all. I didn't know anything about it myself, even though I was brought up as a Catholic, practicing Catholic. I had no idea till after maybe my last year of college I heard the word meditating.
So you grew up in, you were born in Trinidad.
I was, yeah. It's a little island off of Venezuela. We just lived there for 1 year. My dad was in the Air Force, so we moved around quite a bit. I lived in London till I was 7.
Well, what were you... Have you gone back to London? What were your impressions of London, if you remember?
Well, I actually was there for the coronation of the Queen. I think I was like 3 or 4 years old. But it was just a great experience, except we moved back to the States when I was 7. We moved to Alabama.
Oh,
and the kids in Alabama, they didn't like me too much because I was really small for my age. I had been going to school for 2 years already. I could read really well. And my accent, they just thought I was weird. I would say the instead of the. So I became a book person. I think that was the beginning of my introversion and love of books and knowledge.
So you've been a reader ever since you were a small child.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was surprised at only 12 years of age, there was a book that captured your attention. What book was that?
When I was 12, I found a book on how to hypnotize your friends. I was intrigued by that, so I got the book and I practiced, you know. I never really was too good at hypnotizing my friends, but it had a chapter on how to develop the power to hypnotize. And it involved lighting a candle, a single candle, which I got my mom to let me do in the room. I promised I wouldn't burn the house down. And in the dark, you had a single candle, and you just stare at the candle flame and gaze and try to empty your mind. And the book said you would slowly gain occult powers that would help you hypnotize your friend. So I think that was my first introduction to meditation.
So the name of this book, we are familiar with Mesmer because he has left a word in our vocabulary, and that is?
Mesmerism, yeah.
We say mesmerized.
Yeah, back in the 1800s, there was new interest in the occult. People were branching off from traditional religions, I think because of the encounter with the East. And people in Europe started doing seances and there was this whole idea that there was this electromagnetic sort of a force called that Mesmer, who was a doctor, harnessed apparently, and he really got good at hypnotizing people. So he actually even used magnets. He would sometimes move magnets over people around their body. And that was sort of the beginning of, I think, meditation practices in the occult in the West.
My guest is Shelley Joy, and she now lives up in the mountains between Mount Lassen Volcanic Park and Shingletown. And she has written several books, and among these seven books she's written is a new book, Developing Supersensible Perception. Now, right away, Shelley, there's a word that we don't encounter very often, supersensible. We think about a sensible person as somebody who doesn't believe in nonsense.
Yeah. Well, supersensible perception is actually a phrase that Rudolf Steiner came up with. And he actually wrote a book called The Acquisition of Supersensible Perception. So about 10 years ago, I was working on my doctoral coursework, and I had the fortune to study with Dr. Robert McDermott, who wrote the foreword to the book, kindly. He's probably the world's expert on Steiner, and Steiner wrote about 700 books or pamphlets.
That's staggering. And Rudolf Steiner did so many things. He's often just labeled philosopher, but he was a man of many talents.
Yeah, he actually started the Waldorf schools, and the Waldorf schools are all over the world right now. In fact, there was a little controversy recently because they were reluctant to give vaccinations to their kids. So they've fallen a little bit out of favor, I guess. But the idea that Steiner had, and Steiner was a scientist, that's what really intrigued me about him. When I started studying metaphysics, and I looked for people who had scientific backgrounds. And you've heard of the California Institute of Technology. Well, before that, in the 1800s, the big school for science was called the Vienna Institute of Technology. So Steiner got a scholarship to go to the Vienna Institute of Technology. And he had to take a train from the countryside where his family lived, a small village. And he took the train every day that there was school. And he got to know a man who was on the train often with him named Kogunsky, who they called him an herbal master. He was a guy who grew up in the woods and knew all of the botanical secrets of the forest around Vienna. And it's my theory, which I discussed in the book, that probably Steiner, he actually went with this man to his little cottage way out in the deep Vienna woods. I think they probably took some kind of psychotropic entheogenic substance, because Steiner wrote about the guy as someone who had a deep knowledge of the higher worlds, and he was very enthusiastic about him. Back at the same time, drugs were not very much forbidden in the Viennese society. In fact, they used cocaine was a popular drug that people used to try to. Psychiatrists were starting to use it, and Freud actually ended up with a cocaine habit. So they weren't frowned upon, and I just have a feeling part of Steiner's introduction to what he called the higher worlds was some kind of herbal influence, whether mushrooms or some kind of vine, we don't know. But
you used a term that I don't think people are familiar with. These drugs, these plant sources of you were talking about Steiner getting acquainted with, and you used the term entheogen.
Entheogens, that means coming close to God, entheo.
You see the word theo in that word.
Yes, yeah. Theo.
You weren't a bad person if you took these because it took you closer to God.
No, it was medicine. Something that they were exploring, and I think the Theosophists also at the time were getting very popular, and they experimented with opium and hashish and things like that. In fact, a lot of the poets in the early 1800s, the Romantics, wrote poems under the influence of hashish and other things.
So, is that why you took a course in Romantic poets?
I studied engineering. I probably would have been an engineer my whole life and focused on science If I hadn't had this amazing experience just before my final year of electrical engineering.
Well, now you did say that when you graduated, you went to New York and you worked in the World Trade Tower.
I did. I was on the 64th floor of the North Tower. Yeah. Yeah. But so I was an engineer. And well, most of my career, I ended up doing software development for the last 20 years. And I retired and started my PhD in philosophy and religion to try to be able to write about all the things I had learned over the years about how science and mysticism interact and how you could, there really is a scientific basis for mysticism.
My guest is Shelley Joy, and she has a PhD in philosophy, but her undergraduate work was in electrical engineering. Now, I mentioned your time in New York because that was very valuable time as far as your progress toward the subject that you are so fascinated by, because you had an opportunity to study with the well-known teachers. Who are some of the people you had the privilege, I think a privilege, of studying with when you were in New York?
Well, let me go back just a minute to how I diverged from science. I loved science, and as a child, I read a lot of science fiction with my dad. He helped me get interested in that. And of course, you know, Sputnik and the space race and the moon thing made me think that was the thing to explore with science. But the summer before my final year, I somehow got involved with taking LSD on the beach in California. Not many engineers did that at the time, and probably they still don't. But I was very interested in finding God as a Catholic. And the Life magazine had just come out with a big article saying, people take LSD to find God, to talk to God. So I thought, my goodness, I have to try that at least. Well, that experience really opened my mind to what I call consciousness and psychonautics, sailing in consciousness, going deep within.
My guest today is electrical engineer Shelley Joy, but she now writes on the subject of developing supersensible perception. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today is Shelley Joy. She now lives up in the mountains in a little village of Viola, and she writes on the subject of developing supersensible perception. Well, what was your experience with LSD? What was that trip like for you?
It was incredible. I mean, it was the things I saw and felt, and I felt other beings, other consciousnesses, other entities sort of. And this was at night on the beach. And it just opened up a whole new world. And as a science, I was just totally trained in science for the past 3 years prior to that. I thought, this is really the area where science should explore. I mean, this is the new frontier. This is, you know, forget, you know, electronics and space. I want to explore consciousness because it's seems to have been never approached by scientists. And even since then, it hasn't really been, because science tends to work on things they can measure in the material world.
And if they can't measure it, it doesn't exist.
That's pretty much. And, you know, I talked to a few professors in my engineering school about consciousness. I was an electrical engineer, so I thought electricity had something to do with consciousness. It must, you know, because... And they would say, well, you know, we don't deal with that. You need to talked to some philosophy professors or psychology professors. When I talked to them, they didn't know enough about electronics or science. And they would say, well, you know.
So there's this chasm between the disciplines.
And there still is, but it is coming together. The only unfortunate thing is any scientist with really great credentials even who starts to give some credible writings or talks about meditation and the spirit and higher states of consciousness are drugs, for God's sakes, they would pretty much be ostracized, and they have been refused to be published, you know, in scientific journals. One of the world's experts on crystallography at Stanford wrote like the main textbook on crystallography for the whole world. And yet when he started meditating and became a vegetarian and writing about how consciousness should be something that should be studied, he lost his grant money and a technical journal stopped publishing his work. And it's really quite sad and striking, the discrimination that happens.
I was thinking that's how you could write this book, because you are not really no longer a member of this community where they would pass judgment on you. Oh, Shelley, what do you mean writing such a book on supersensible perception?
Yeah. But one of my professors, Brian Swim at California.
Another big name.
He is a cosmologist, a mathematical cosmologist. He went to school in Washington State. And now when he started writing, of course, he writes about things that get rejected by physical scientists pretty much. So he's a main professor at CIIS in San Francisco. And he told me, he said, Shelley, you know, you're doing wonderful things and writing wonderful things, but you have to be prepared to be criticized on every side. The philosophers are going to criticize you for trying to describe mystical things in terms of science. And the scientists are going to totally discredit you because you're talking about woo-woo things, you know, about mysticism and meditation and entheogens, psychedelics. But I persevered. I did have another career, quite successful in engineering, but I spent most of my spare time collecting books and reading them and taking notes and filling journals. And at some point, I felt like I really needed to share some of my insights with other people, with the public. So when I retired, I decided to go for a PhD and fill in things that I didn't know from philosophy and religion and really studied it in an academic way so I could write about my experiences and the ideas about the intersection of science and mysticism. But getting back to supersensible perception, everybody has it, but to different degrees. And it's been pretty much suppressed by our culture because we're so materialistic. And we deal with things we can see externally and touch externally. Supersensible perception is looking within. And we go there when we dream at night. We're having actually supersensible perception, a certain mode of it in our dreams. And mystics throughout many cultures and many centuries have gone into this realm. The way Steiner talks about it, he says we have three ways of thinking. One is physical thinking, which is like you're just from what you can see and touch and talk about. That's what we think, and it's a very passive sort of a thinking. We can watch TV and watch the news and get our ideas, you know, filtered into us, but it's very passive. He says a better level of thinking, the second one, is called active thinking. And active thinking is what people strive for in our educational system. By learning a lot of facts and a lot of words and a lot of details, we're able to start thinking on our own. And that's the main goal of education and higher education especially. But Steiner said the most important thing and that is intuitive thinking. And it's intuitive thinking is you're going within, is a new mode of thinking, almost an evolutionary development of normal thinking. And it's something that has been developed by mystics. It's something that you can experience to some extent through certain drugs. But it can really be developed through practice of certain practices. And most of these practices are described in different religious terms in religions, but they overlap. And I was able to be fortunate enough to study deeply not only Christianity, which was my root, but also Hinduism and Buddhism and Taoism to some extent. And I tried to find where the techniques, as an engineer, you're always looking for practical things, not just, you know, how things work. You want to know what will work, what's practical, what can you do? I found that Steiner's work was really practical. He gave specific ways of trying to develop supersensible perception. And what is it that you perceive in supersensible perception? Well, it's sort of a collective consciousness thing. Carl Jung called it the collective unconscious. But that's slightly misleading because this collective unconscious is actually a form of consciousness. It's not something that's asleep. And I also ran into, in New York, the work of Teilhard de Chardin. And Teilhard de Chardin was a Catholic priest who was also a highly trained geologist. And he began writing about consciousness as something that is evolving and that some people have their consciousness evolved further than others. And the ultimate level of consciousness, he thought, was what he called the noosphere. The noosphere comes from the word N-O-U-S. It sort of means we are thinking or looking inwards. It's a certain awareness, but a collective awareness. And the idea is that everybody's broadcasting these thoughts and feelings, and they go into this larger realm of collective consciousness. And when we die, we transition into that. But while you're alive, it's possible to actually resonate with that, to commune with that to some extent.
My guest is Shelley Joy, and she is an electrical engineer by training, but she has been interested in supersensible perception. And her newest book is Developing Supersensible Perception. And part of what you have to deal with, Shelley, I think, is to reconcile all these different labels. People label things according to their own experience, and then you say, oh, well, in fact, you have a chart. When Patanjali says this, it's the same as what, say, Steiner means when he says this.
Yes, yes. You have to realize that everyone comes with their own perspective, filtered through their own language and their culture and their time, because even English means different things now than it. My mother wouldn't know what it meant to tweet, you know. She died about 20 years ago. But so I feel that much of my effort is to translate the teachings that have come from people who have gone deeply into the superconscious.
You even mentioned, say, two types of thinking. And a lot of people say, well, when you meditate, you don't think. You should not be thinking.
Exactly. And that's true. In fact, when I was working on my my master's degree in San Francisco, I was studying actually Indian philosophy because I wanted to see all the different ways Indians thought about God, but also the techniques that they would give on how they felt it was useful to develop a communication with God and with the other world, the invisible world, what Steiner calls the higher worlds. So I used to drive out to Mount Tamalpais, and I would say, okay, today I'm going to try really hard to think without words. And that was a big thing for me for a while. I even wrote an essay for the president of the school. I took a class with Dr. Chowdhury. About thinking without words. What does that mean? And over the years, I found that that really is the key to a lot of things. You really can think without words because, after all, our language, from probably hundreds of thousands of years, humans didn't have language. You know, they maybe used some kind of sign language and certain grunts meant something, but they were able to think, and animals are able to think, obviously. So thinking without words was really important to me. And then when I read Steiner, he said the key to beginning to develop supersensible perception is to learn to think without using words. I thought, my gosh, I've been this was my idea. So He focuses a lot on the silence. He says, when you go into the silence, and what he means by silence is, and it's the same thing as Indian Patanjali Yoga teaches, is the form of meditation is you get very quiet, physically quiet. Ideally, you're in a quiet room or I actually, when I lived in Oakland, California, I used to wear earplugs. I got some really good earplugs from the shooting range because I heard that they had great earplugs. And then you also attenuate your visual perception. So in the dark, so sitting in the dark in a very quiet place, you try to let your mind come to a quiet place. In other words, you learn to kind of turn the tap dialed on your memories. You try not to remember things like, how long have I been meditating, or did I forget to mail that letter? You know, you learn to just let your mind quiet down. Because when the mind is very, very busy, it shields and masks supersensible perception. And in fact, in neurophysiology, they found that most of the activity of your brain is acting on the outer region, the very thin outer layer of the brain. When you're thinking in words and trying to remember things and talking to yourself, your mind is very active electrically on the outside of the brain, on the very far edges. And what that does is it shields any kind of energy or communication going into or coming from the very deepest part of your brain. And this has been found in science. They call these mechanisms Faraday cages. So radio engineers build these cages of metal to do experiments in to keep all of the energy from coming in. So basically, thinking keeps supersensible perception from occurring. Now, when you're sleeping at night, you stop thinking, you know, hopefully. Otherwise, I mean, sometimes I wake up at 3 and start thinking and I can't go back to sleep.
You know what I view those times, though, is, this is just, I'm going to get a download. So I'm awake there and I just see what, I have no idea what this download will be, but I just say, well, rather than sit here fretting that I'm not sleeping, I'll just see what comes.
A download. You know, I had a professor, Dr. Spiegelberg, who was a president of CIS years ago, and he had lived in India, traveled around as almost like a monk. He was born in Germany, and there was a period in the 30s when the Germans were really interested in mysticism and the occult, and so a lot of them would go to India. Anyway, he would say that the way he gives talks is he stops the flow of his thought, and he imagines that there are birds flying up there, and each one of those birds is a thought, and he tries to reach up and capture one of those birds and bring it down, channel it sort of, and it comes out as a beautiful idea. And he said, that's a very mysterious thing that's happening.
My guest is Shelley Joy, and her training is in physics, electrical engineering, but she has written a book, Developing Supersensible Perception, and you spend a lot of time on the information from Rudolf Steiner, and there's a quote in your book by him, "There slumber in every human being faculties by means of which he can acquire for himself a knowledge of higher worlds. There remains only one question, how to set to work to develop such faculties." And so I'm guessing that's really kind of why you wrote this book, Shelley, is it? Why did you write this book?
I wrote the book to try to share some really practical techniques with people so that they might be able to start developing their own ways of intuiting and perceiving these, what Steiner calls these higher worlds. In fact, Teilhard would say if you're able to communicate with the collective unconscious, with the noosphere, even your ancestors are there. So people who have died recently, when I meditate, I actually feel like I'm touching people I've known and people who are alive now, of course. But it's almost like that old thing of Bell telephone, reach out and touch someone. So in the real silence of your mind when you're meditating and your external senses are attenuated, it's maybe dark and quiet, and you're sitting on your little cushion. I use like a Japanese zafu cushion. if you think of someone, I think it's almost like dialing their phone number or their email address, who knows. But if you think of someone who you've loved and known before, like your mother, your father, people who've been close to you, you actually feel something in your heart. You feel a resonance with them. So I know that they're there somewhere in these other dimensions. And I have a feeling that this is sort of the basis of a lot of the Madame Blavatsky and Theosophist seances people used to
do. When you mentioned your heart, you touched, which is a very natural thing to do. When you mentioned your heart, your hand went up to your heart. And that brings up this notion of energy centers in the body that we don't even have terminology for. We have to borrow the Sanskrit word chakra for these energy centers. And sometimes when the subject comes up and people say, well, I don't feel anything. But I just bet that most people, I don't know if most, the heart center is one that maybe the first chakra, they step over to the edge of a high cliff and they get, woo, that first chakra says, hey, watch out, don't step any further, your survival would not. But people see a puppy or a baby and it touches their heart. That's that fourth chakra that you do touch on the chakras in your book. Maybe you'd like to say something about the chakras.
Yeah, and the heart chakra is a really important one. In fact, it's not just something in India that the Indian mystics discovered. There's this whole a group of people throughout the last centuries that focus on the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And of course, the Aztecs were real big about hearts. Maybe shouldn't
scary
go there
way.
Right now.
Yeah, pretty
but
scary.
I mean, hearts are a big thing to us. We have Valentine's Day, and we give us pictures. But the heart, in Japanese, the heart is the organ of the mind that thinks, which is unusual, you know, to Western scientists because they figure your meat mind with all of the neurons is where all the action is. But in India, these. India has its own technology, a spiritual technology. India, after all, was blessed with lots of nature, food, fruit growing off the trees, and fish and birds. They didn't have to worry too much about harsh winters and starving. Whereas in the north, in Europe, it was rather much harsher. And so the sages of Europe used to try to study the external world. And I think that's the root of our material science. You know, trying to master the external world that we can touch and see and measure, mainly so we can find food and survive. The Indians, the sages, they had all that. So they started asking, why are we here? And they developed like about 78 religions, I think, classical ones, because they were interested in the afterlife and the deeper levels of awareness and nature all around them.
Well, now, as you're saying that, I think back to the chakras, because the northern Europeans then were concerned about the first and second chakras because they had to worry about survival.
The stomach chakra, yeah.
And then the in India, they were past those survival chakras and they could focus more on the higher chakras.
Yeah. And I've, of course, really studied the chakras with several different teachers, but also using my own collection of books and studying, I really got interested in physiology in my 20s and bought some anatomy books. I was living in New York, so I had some wonderful libraries and bookstores around there.
The New York City Library.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
This is before the days of the internet, so it was a tremendous resource that you had.
Yes, and I was looking for, I guess I was looking in the wrong places for a while. I was looking in psychology books to find something about consciousness and higher levels of consciousness. But one day I came across a book open on the library table, and I opened the book and it said, In Search of the Miraculous. I thought, well, this sounds pretty interesting. And then I started reading the introduction and it was written by a mathematician. Well, I'm always a sucker for people with degrees in science. You know, I had at least back then more. So I checked out this book and I found that here's a whole different kind of book I had never suspected. I thought there were two kinds of books, fiction, especially science fiction, which I love, and textbooks, you know, magnetic theory and calculus and all that. You know, it's exciting to me at times, but it's dry even for me much of the time. But here was a book that was written by a mathematician, a Russian, that was fascinating. And he had these theories I had never heard about before. But about that we're all full of tiny little eyes. We're a collection of small eyes, and only one can sit in the driver's seat at a time. It's almost like a bus. You think of a bus, and I have, you know, the parent eye, the student eye, the eye that goes crazy at parties, maybe, or the eye that's talking to someone who doesn't speak English very well. There's almost like a, and only one can be in control at a time. So anyway, Uspensky said that he had
this
a teacher.
This is the Russian mathematician, yes. Now, back to that.
He had a teacher named Gurdjieff. Gurdjieff was from the Middle East and was a really wise man. Gurdjieff said there's really there's one eye, a deeper eye, that usually only comes out in dreams, and it takes a lot of practice to extract it and make and shift your center of awareness from one of the little eyes, your personality, X, for instance, to the big eye, which is more important. But finding this book made me realize there's another kind of book. And so that helped me to start looking for books that were written by people who had good educations in science, hopefully, but also had discovered the whole realm of supersensible reality, higher dimensions or other dimensions of reality.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm here with my guest, Shelley Joy, and she is telling us how we can develop supersensible perception. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Shelley Joy, who writes about how to develop your supersensible perceptions. You know, I was thinking when you were talking earlier about I don't know if you want to call them supernatural, but I knew a young child who, when she was younger, she saw things that we adults did not see. And I asked her about it when she got older, and she said, and she dismissed it.
Our culture tends to make people tune that out. If you have anything like Steiner would call supersensible perception, they would say, no, maybe you need some, special psychiatric drugs because, you know, it's escape from reality. In fact, that was the big criticism of any kind of drugs like marijuana or LSD or psilocybin. They're escapes from reality. Well, I always thought that reality is all kinds of realities. And people would say, oh, that's dreams are not real. Well, I would say they're pretty real. I experience them almost every night. And they're, I mean, usually in color and, what's happening here? This is real stuff. So let me just get back to the chakras a minute. I think I had a physiology book and I discovered I was trying to, I'd been learning from a teacher, a Tibetan Tulku, his name was Shongnam Trungpa Rinpoche. I followed him for a couple of years in New York. I went to all his lectures and I went on retreats. He had a place called Tail of the Tiger in Barnett, Vermont. So I went some extended retreats. The chakras are centers of your body which are full of nerves and capillaries. I discovered that from my physiology books. So for instance, if you concentrate on the chakra of your abdomen, well, it's almost like another brain. That's the way some mystics call it, that you have several different brains in your body.
And this whole notion is alien to most of us. Like, oh, your brain's in your head, and that's it. That's where consciousness resides.
Yeah, but people—
And you're saying, and not just you, No, there's consciousness.
Of course, people can be brain dead and still alive. So what's running their abdomen and their intestines and what's running their heart and keeping their body alive? Well, it's almost like distributed computing. You have different brains within your body, and let's just call each chakra a separate brain area. And by focusing on these, what happens is my son had a science fair project once of biofeedback. And so we got these things for him where you tie a sensor on your finger and you watch and see if you can make the temperature go up. And by focusing on it, definitely you can. Almost anyone can. Well, what happens is when you're focusing awareness, trying to feel something, the capillaries, the little blood capillaries dilate. They get wider. So more blood rushes there, and more blood feeds it with more oxygen, activates it more, and cleans it out, too.
You know, I actually had the opportunity to see this. There was a woman, she didn't make it known, but who was a healer. And I watched her hold her hands over a person, and her hands got red as if she had dipped them in hot water.
It's amazing how you can gain control. And this is the whole idea of developing supersensible perception. So one of the ways is focusing on a chakra. And of course, Christians would focus on the heart chakra, and they wouldn't call it a chakra. They'd say Sacred Heart of Jesus. But there's one in your throat, you know, which controls speech, in your heart. And then just below your heart, at the real right under your lungs in the diaphragm, there's a chakra that controls a lot of your inner organs, like your liver and your pancreas and your gallbladder.
Where we have gut feelings.
Yeah, and of course, there's one down near your perineum that seems to control, or in some people not control, their sexual brain down there. And by focusing on them while you're meditating, hopefully you learn to attenuate your thoughts, attenuate your memories, stop thinking in words, and just try to feel that area, which the Indians call a chakra, trying to feel, say, your heart chakra. And by focusing there, the capillaries expand slightly. More blood oxygen goes there, and they're also full of nerves. There's what we call nerve plexuses in those areas. So that was a real eye-opener for me and got me working with my chakras, and I still do when I meditate. That's one of the things I usually try to do at the beginning of meditation. I usually say a few prayers. Sometimes they're Catholic prayers. In fact, when in my childhood, the Catholic Mass was said in Latin, so I learned the Lord's Prayer in Latin and the Ave Maria, Grazia Plena. So I say some of those.
You know, Shelley, that might surprise people that if you become a scientist, then you would reject religion. But you don't do that. You see apparently no adversarial relationship.
Well, many scientists do, I mean, reject religion. But religion's a way most people... It's their only way of sort of contacting these supersensible higher realms. And through prayer is really a real way to do it. Coming together with people to pray, following some liturgical routine, and saying the same prayer that you get to know, you're sort of tuning in. The esoteric approach is saying that when you say a prayer, or in India they call them mantras, you say the same thing over and over. You are actually communicating or resonating with all of the prayers of all the people who have ever said that prayer throughout history. You're becoming sort of a part of that community and that feeling and that energy. So this is really the importance of prayer. The subtitle of my book is Knowledge of the Higher Worlds Through Entheogens, Prayer, and Non-Dual Awareness. And,
you know, I did want to get back to that because you've mentioned what entheogens are. Prayer, of course, is what you're talking about now. And I want to get around to, when you finish your thought here, non-dual awareness.
Non-dual awareness. It also really actually ties into quantum mechanics. Everything is connected, and quantum physicists would say that too. Everything is connected in some grand field. There's nothing really separate in the universe. So we typically think that we are separate, that we're separate people and separate beings, and God is up there maybe, and we're down here, and too bad we can't get to know him a little bit better. But There are a number of new movements in meditation in the world, like centering prayer. I think Christians was started in Colorado by a monk. Centering prayer is a way of non-dual awareness. You learn to stop thinking. Stop thinking in words. Stop thinking about yourself, and also attenuate memories. So your memories, your brain is not very active. It gets really kind of quiet. And that allows you to start being aware of everything, sort of. When you're aware that there's really no distinction between you and the universe, you are part of the universe, and the universe is just an extension of you, that that's what I mean by non-dual awareness. It's the kind of the goal of supersensible perception. And to really master it, you should be able to do it when you're talking to someone else or in the middle of San Francisco during rush hour even. But that's a pretty advanced technique, I suppose.
My guest is Shelley Joy, and her book is Developing Sensible Perception. I want to remind people of the title of that because you have a blurb on your book from Dr. Deepak Chopra, and he says, read Developing Supersensible Perception to learn more. His quote is, if we are indeed non-local beings with dormant, unrealized potentials, then we all have the ability to be extraordinary. And then he says, read this book to learn more. So you have a scientific background. So a lot of you bring that to what you write in your book.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have personal experience. And in your book, you talk about something that happened. You call this section The Light in the Forest.
Oh, yes, yes.
And I imagine that there are people besides you who have a similar experience and don't dare breathe a word of it. So you're kind of brave, Shelley, to describe this experience. This happened to me and claim that it's true. So maybe you'll kind of blaze a trail for other people. Say, yeah, golly, that happened to me, but I wouldn't tell anybody. So what happened to you in the forest?
Okay, well, I'll read a little passage
sure.
from the book because I think I wrote, I tried carefully to say what I felt and thought. This happened maybe 6 months after my real breakthrough taking LSD and discovering there's a whole world and universe out there that, you know, isn't really being explored by science. But I went back to my electrical engineering senior classes this time, you know, studying electrophysics and some quantum mechanics and radio communication theory. So I'll just read it to you.
Okay.
It was around midnight at a place known as Hamilton Pool, 20 miles southwest of Austin, above an ancient crack in the earth known as the Balcones Fault. Fed by a 50-foot waterfall, the large pool of water had been created when the limestone dome over an underground cavern had collapsed due to quakes and erosion many millennia past. Three classmates and I had come to swim after a week of final exams at the University of Texas. The night was quiet except for the chirping of small frogs, and pale clouds obscured the stars. After swimming in the deepest part of the pool, not far from the waterfall, we soon gathered by the edge of the pool and talked quietly. The first noticeable sign of something unusual was the abrupt cessation of the frogs peeping, part of that incessant forest murmur of crickets and frogs on a summer night. But abruptly they stopped, leaving only the gentle splashing sound of the waterfall across the pool. Soon a barely perceptible glow appeared far down the creek, back to our right, where the water flowed from the pool toward the Perdinales River, about a half a mile to the west. The light, growing and fading in rhythmic pulsations, bobbed slowly up and down along the creek, obscured by intervening pine trees and brush. We sat in silence, backs against a large boulder on the shores of Hamilton Pool, both mesmerized and nervous. We were familiar with ominous urban legends that circulated in Austin, warning of nighttime horror in the forested hills country, stories of people alone in the woods at night who had mysteriously vanished, echoed some years later in a movie called The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. At long last, emerging from the obscuring brush, what appeared to be a spherical object of pale opal phosphorescence floated into view, floating high above the creek. Gently glowing and slowly pulsing, the orb majestically moved along the rim of the cliff overhanging the pool of water. After what seemed to be an eternity, the softly glowing spherical shape reached the waterfall, and after rising slightly and moving closer to the falling water, the apparition slowly dipped three times, bobbing and weaving in a stately rhythmical pattern above the water in front of the waterfall, like some gigantic moth in the night. Eventually, it resumed its motion along the sheltering rim, moving ever closer to us where we sat on the pebble-strewn beach, speechless, paralyzed, more in awe than in fear.
Now, some people have these experiences by themselves, so they can kind of talk themselves out of it. Well, I really didn't see that. It was my imagination. But you've got three other people there witnessing this.
Yes. And the next morning we talked about it, and we all had seen the same thing, which was incredible. Let me go just a tiny bit more. Finally, the apparition reached us where we sat on the shore, our backs pressed against the cool boulder. There it paused, hovering above us, 10 feet up, a small, silent, spherical galaxy of tiny bright stars and glowing filaments, flashing and flickering. Within the mysterious luminous orb could be seen patterns like thin contrails, all bound within a sphere, approximately 2 feet in diameter, about the size of a large beach ball. Time stood still. I held my breath, speechless, in awe, verging on disbelief for what seemed an eternity. At last it began again its slow, bobbing movement away from us, continuing its journey above the beach edge until it reached the creek that drained the pool. Then it continued west above the creek in a slow, stately fashion, moved back into the swampy forest from which it first appeared.
This is Shelley Joy, and she is reading from her new book, Developing Supersensible Perception. And in it, she tells us how we can develop supersensible perception. And these are not just your ideas, but you have reliable sources, some of them quite ancient, as to how to develop supersensible perception.
This orb really was an amazing wake-up call. I mean, I had already been kicked into gear about things not totally scientific in my school studies through the LSD experience. But seeing this in the forest, at first I thought it was a UFO. But, you know, UFOs are always supposed to be machine-like, you know? This was anything but machine-like.
Well, you have a drawing in your book, Moiré Patterns in Spherical Volume. So there is so much more in your book. For people who want technical, who want scientific explanations for this, you provide that. Thank you, Shelley. It's been a pleasure talking to you about this book.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Shelley Renee Joy, and her book is Developing Supersensible Perception.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.